I'm Mark Strassman, producer and host of BookChat.org. We're at the Le Méridien Hotel in Beverly Hills. We're about to speak to Ed McBain / Evan Hunter, who's just written The Last Dance. Welcome to BookChat.org.
Good to be here. Thank you.
I was listening to NPR this morning, and the discussion was one of the discussions was about Angela's Ashes and Bonfire of the Vanities as books and as movies. You've been a screenwriter and a novelist. What can you say about how it feels for you to write one or the other, and about what you can do as a creative artist to express your vision through those two means?
I always looked at it. I've done a lot of screenplays based on my own work, and I've done some based on other people's work. And I always look at it as a translation. I feel I'm translating something to another medium, and I'm not sorry if I have to lose things in order to make it work in the other medium. I have no regrets if I have to add things to make it work. The idea is to just make it work.
When you do original screenplays, how does that differ from writing a novel in terms of what you can say or how you have to say it?
You don't have to spend as much time setting things up. In a screenplay, you can say, interior, a luxury apartment on Manhattan's Upper East Side. In a novel, you have to describe that apartment. You have to come into it. You have to make sure the reader sees it as if he was seeing it on the screen. In a novel, you have to describe the clothing, excuse me, a person is wearing. In the movie, you say she is elegantly dressed, and the costume designer dresses her as elegantly as she sees fit.
Sounds a lot easier to write a screenplay. And although most of your work has been writing novels.
Yeah, I've done, I don't know how many screenplays, a couple of dozen, I would guess. It's not easier. The hard thing about a screenplay is the time limitation. You're locked into 2 hours for the most part. I know today there are several movies out that run 3 hours and more, but the audience is not used to those, and it's sort of a strain.
So essentially, it's is it easier writing a screenplay then? Or does the constraint of time make up for the ease of composition?
If it were not for the time limitation, it would be easier. I've done miniseries, and they were fun to do because there was no time limitation. I had 6 hours, 8 hours, and you could just go, and that was fun.
So you essentially have the best of both worlds there. You can concentrate on the things you want to in the screenplay, and you don't have to worry about the time like as you do in a movie.
Yeah. In a screenplay or in a teleplay, death is, in the eyes of producers in any event, two people talking, two heads talking. They don't want to see that. So a scene that's 3 minutes long is a long, long scene in a motion picture.
Now, in terms of miniseries, this book, The Last Dance, is in fact the 50th in the series of novels you've written as Ed McBain. So in a sense, if that were to be taken to the screen, would be pretty much the most epic miniseries ever written.
Yeah, it would. It would be nice, wouldn't it? I would love to see a 50-part miniseries on the 87 precinct on the television screen.
Well, we're doing this on the internet, and I've been experimenting with audio dramas on the internet, and I would imagine that for close to the cost of one Bruce Willis picture, one of his big commercial pictures, we'd be able to do most of those 50 episodes in audio anyway.
Dramatized or being read? Dramatized.
Right, dramatized.
Yeah, that would be fun, wouldn't it? You know, in Europe, dramatic radio series are still on. They used to be many, many moons ago in America, but they still are in Europe.
Well, this show will be audible in Europe, anyone who has the internet there. Let's talk a little bit about The Last Dance, since that's a book you've just written. How is it like the previous 49, and how is it different?
It's like the previous ones in that the same cast of characters are there, although they change in each of the books and grow in each of the books. It's different in that I think as the series has progressed, there's more concentration on characters and less on not less on plot, but an equal concentration on characters and plot. And I think there are some very interesting characters in this one. And the story takes us back to a musical that was done in 1925 that is being revived in the present. And it allows me to introduce a lot of Broadway-type characters.
That musical, in a way, is the Hitchcockian MacGuffin in the story, isn't it?
In a way, except that Hitchcock's own definition of the MacGuffin was that it's the thing the good guy has, the bad guy wants, and everybody forgets 10 minutes after the movie starts.
Although, importantly, that is what the neutral guy has and the bad guys want in this case.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
Why don't you talk about some of the characters and what kind of attributes you think they most exemplify for the reader?
What attributes the characters? I think decency. The continuing characters. The reader looks upon these men and women as part of his or her own family. They're hardworking, decent people trying to make sense out of crime and punishment, and trying to catch the bad guys and put them away.
Say just a little bit about the plot and who the bad guys seem to be and what they did and so on.
Okay, the cops are called in because an old man is found dead in bed by his daughter who's going to visit him one morning, and she keeps insisting that it probably is a heart attack because he's had two previous heart attacks, and then this may be another one, a fatal one. But the body and the signs on the body show all the indications of a hanging. And what the police are interested in knowing is whether or not this guy was hanged first and transported to the bed, and if so, did the daughter have anything to do with it? And it leads from there into some other complications that are too complicated to go into in a short radio show.
And for which people will have to buy the book and read it and find out exactly what happened.
Yeah, I hope. That is my sincere wish.
Now, that's something about the characters. Now, the setting is this, it says here, the fictional city of Isola. Did I pronounce it right?
Well, it's pronounced various ways by various citizens of the city. It's Isola, 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 whatever mood strikes the person speaking it.
Well, two things about it. Does it refer to the alienation and anomie of the city?
No, it means, Isola means island in Italian. And when I first started the series, I was, I sold it on the premise that it was to be New York City. But as I began writing it, I changed it to a mythical city, and I kept Isola as Manhattan Island. Yeah.
Because as I'm reading it, I was trying to match it to New York, and the geography was different.
In the beginning, it was just New York City turned slightly askew, but over the years, it really has evolved into a mythical city with imaginary geographical locations and historical backgrounds. It really is mythical.
Well, that gives us another page for our in-development internet audio series, which would be a map of the city with all of the different places and locations and historical moments that took place there and so on to help people find their way around.
When are we starting this project?
As soon as we finish the interview, so let's keep going. a general idea that I'd like to deal with in specific terms of this book is there seem to be three places. There's a real world, there's the fictional world that you create, and then there's the world within the reader's mind. When you're working, do you think of those three places, and do you go back and forth between them?
I think of the reader mostly. I try to create a reality for him that he can feel and smell and sense in the weather and in everything around him. I try to make the reader feel like a fly on the wall with these scenes that are developing with him, as if all around him. And forgive me, I'm not being politically incorrect when I say him. It's easier than saying him or her. I sometimes feel myself as if I'm a fly on the wall. I'll be writing a scene and I'll think, my God, I've been here before. And I know I haven't. I haven't been in that particular... there's a scene in the book, for example, when Corella meets with a stool pigeon and a shooting occurs in the pizzeria where they're meeting for breakfast. And I could swear that I'd been in that room when the shooting took place, and pizza toppings are flying all over the floor and people are running out of the place in panic. I could swear I'd been there, and I know I haven't.
One thing I'd like to, both compliment you and ask you about is the way the characters are both distinctive and memorable and individual, but they're normal. They're believable. Does that just happen, or does it take a lot of hard work?
I don't believe in these superheroes, you know, and I don't believe in novels where the superhero has 10 minutes to save the world from extinction and does it by his own efforts, and with no help from the FBI or anybody else. I don't believe in that.
So, in fact, you believe in ensemble solutions to crimes?
I believe that these are professional people who know their work and who go about it in a way that brings about a plausible solution.
I have to say, there was a police officer directing traffic a few blocks from here, and I looked at him, and I thought, he must have a family and be a regular guy, instead of he's some category of socio-political analysis, which was happened because I read the book, because the police officers here are like that.
Yeah, the police officers here specifically caused me a lot of trouble, you know, because I try to write sympathetically about cops, and very often they behave in very unsympathetic ways. But I hope that causes the reader to think that the cop for us is the cop, especially in a free society, becomes a symbol of a paramilitary figure who is only steps away from a jackbooted guy in uniform. And, you know, we can visualize him breaking down our door and carting us off and never heard from again. So we have an inbred dislike for cops, and I try to make cops sympathetic.
Is there an implicit political agenda or perspective in what you write here?
No, I don't think so. I have a firm belief in society, you know, and in civilization. And I think we've worked for thousands and thousands of years to build a body of law that protects us not only against others but against ourselves, because we know what we're capable of. And I like to feel that cops are the people we hire to help us preserve that body of law.
One of them is Fat Ollie Watts. Can you talk about him? Or Weeks, I'm sorry. I got him confused with his fictional character. And you sort of play around with these things a little bit.
Yeah, there was a book recently that had a character called Fat Ollie Watts. And, you know, my character, Fat Ollie Weeks, has been around for a long, long time. And this was a police novel. And anyone writing police novels who has not read The 87 Precinct has not done his homework.
So this was a subtle dig at those guys. I thought you were making fun of yourself.
No, I was baring my fangs. Fat Ollie Weeks, my Fat Ollie, is a consummate bigot. And he doesn't even know he's a bigot, but he hates everything. He's an equal opportunity bigot.
There's another point where I think you are making fun of yourself, where there's a couple and they're sort of bantering and they are talking about songs they like, and one of them says, "Strangers When We Meet," which of course is a novel you wrote, not a song that Frank Sinatra sang. So what's the place that you assign to these asides and little jokes and so on that try to liven up and leaven the more morbid aspects of the story?
Yeah, I like to inject a lot of humor into the books, and part of it is humor at my own expense. There was one book where a character kept insisting that Alfred Hitchcock wrote The Birds. And, you know, I wrote the screenplay for The Birds. But this character just keeps insisting, and it won't take no for an answer. And the cops are sort of, you know, almost half convinced that Alfred Hitchcock did write it. But I like to keep a lighter side to this. We are, after all, dealing with dead bodies and people trying to find out what made them dead. And if there's no humor in it, then I think it becomes something we can't deal with. The cops themselves, who are dealing with murder and homicide, deal with it in a leaven it with humor so that they can bear it.
What's been your own experience with real police officers? Are they happy to have these books out there? They don't like their secrets given away? They think they're favorably portrayed? What's the overall story there?
I think they're happy for the most part. I don't get very many letters from cops, but they show up at signings and tell me how much they like the books. The only letters I get from cops are the ones that tell me I've made some kind of mistake with guns. I don't keep a gun myself. I'm not familiar with the handling of guns, and anything I write about guns is the result of research, and sometimes it's faulty.
Do you do additional research for each book, or you pretty much know what you're talking about by now?
No, new research for each book into drugs, guns, technical aspects of police work, because it changes all the time.
Were there any particularly memorable pieces of research that went into The Last Dance?
Yeah, a drug that features in the book, the date rape drug. I'm not even sure how it's pronounced. I think it's Rofinol or Rofinol. I'm not sure. But I had to do a lot of research on that to find out the effects of it and how it works exactly.
How would you say, then, the books have evolved from the beginning, both in terms of your writing them and what they are like, and in terms of the genre, which of course, well, you can tell it about why you took another name to publish them, and now police procedurals are all the rage in all the media. How did that happen, and how do you feel about it?
I'm flattered in some instances that the 87 precinct has been so imitated or has been an influence on series that came along, notably television series. I'm not so flattered when I feel that a series is a ripoff with just slight alterations in character and locale. I think it. When I first started writing the 87 Precinct novels, the role of the police in most detective fiction was as the bad guy. If the cop would just get out of the way, then the private eye could solve this crime in 10 minutes flat. But the cops were always bringing him in for questioning and suspecting him of committing the murder and all that. That has changed. The cops are now the good guys, and for the most part. And I think, as part of the influence of the 87 precinct, there are now novels set in every small town in America has a cop series going in it. You know, you would think murders are being committed every 10 seconds in America with the proliferation of cop novels.
Although, obviously, it's a genre that goes back to the first chapter of the Bible and to Oedipus Rex, so murder is a perennial favorite of readers and viewers, I guess.
The First Amendment? No, it's not. The commandment, it is not, right, though, is it? Thou shalt not kill, is it?
I think
honor thy God, yeah.
Yeah. It is pretty high up there. We're almost out of time, but what I would like you to do... Before you read this section that I'd like you to read, maybe you could talk about the subject in more general terms, as it appears in the book, the subject of race relations and race in America. The presidential candidates on the Democratic side, anyway, are making it an issue, and Martin Luther King's birthday was celebrated yesterday, and so on, and it's, speaking of perennials, a perennial American issue, obviously.
Yeah.
Could you say something about it in general, and then I'm going to have you read something about your effort to solve the problem, it seems to me.
Well, my effort to solve, I'll talk about that first, is to have a white policeman and a black chief deputy inspector, who is a cop, a doctor as well, have an affair together. And my hope is that by personalizing it, by making this two people and not just two symbols, black and white, but make them people to understand how maybe black and blacks and whites in America can at long last come together. The O.J. Simpson trial was a real wake-up, you know, where we saw how, however cosmetically we were glossing over the problem, it existed, that every white in America felt O.J. was guilty and every black in America felt he was innocent. So there's a real disparity there and a real difference of opinion. And my own personal opinion is that until we start giving blacks a real honest piece of the pie, they're not going to feel as if they have a share in America. And I just try to present all the blacks in my books, whether they're good blacks or bad blacks, as human beings, like everyone. And I don't know what you're going to ask me to read. I haven't looked at it yet, but... Oh, yeah. Oh, I like that scene. This is a love scene between Bert Kling, who is the white cop, and Sharon Cook, who is the black cop. She tasted of every black woman he had ever known. Matter of fact, she was the only black woman he had ever known, the only woman of whatever color he ever hoped to know in the near or distant future. He considered it fortunate that she felt the same way about him, that somehow in this troubled tribal universe, two people from very definitely different tribes had met and decided to give it an honest shot. He thought it miraculous, and so did she, that in the face of overwhelming odds, they were actually making a go of it. Just think of it. A little colored girl from Diamondback grows up to be a deputy police chief, and a white boy on a bicycle he won grows up to be a police detective, and in this hurried, hating city, they find each other and fall in love with each other. Go tell that to your Hutus and Tutsis, your Albanians and Serbs, your Arabs and Jews. They both knew that the God, country, and brotherhood bit they'd each and separately had drummed into their heads in school wasn't quite where it was at today. They were a black woman and a white man living together in the real world. What they shared was not some idealistic democratic sentiment premised on a likeness. They knew that much of what they felt for each other had to do with identical likes and dislikes, yes, but that really wasn't all of it. They had similar senses of humor, yes, and they were in the same line of work, more or less, and yes, they had the same tastes in movies and books and plays, and they both liked basketball, and they both voted identically and yearned for a house and three kids if that was in their future somewhere. But this was America, you know, and so they wondered and worried about that future and were cautious about wishing too hard for it. In the darkness of the night, where there was no color or lack of color, if they ever thought about whether their samenesses had created the strong and unusual bond between them, they each and separately might have concluded that it had also been their differences.
The a hopeful a part of a very enjoyable book, and I wanted to thank you for writing it, and the other 49, and keep going.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was a wonderful interview. I enjoyed it.